Well, this is a little ditty called Il Torto La Forenzo La Trenzo Minestrone Statazit.
Here comes the colonel. Gracious.
That's not funny. I mean, it isn't funny. Why do people think it's funny? It isn't funny. All right. Welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. Of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. And before we get back to Tim O'Connor to tell us about the student volunteers working with MetroCon this year, and then our treat of the day, Catherine Leslie, the Executive Director of Engineers Without Borders, a sponsor of this year's Humanitarian Technology Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on in San Jose, California in October. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments, the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information and get around to the coin jar here for today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of youth. Information. How can I?
Yes, I see. We have aroused once again the spirit of the fountain by throwing in the coins. All right.
Oh, spirit of the fountain.
Do you have an answer for this one? Huh? We had the obvious last show. We had the obvious. How long did the Hundred Years' War last? You seem to have an answer for that. Well, tell me, oh, spirit of the fountain, which country makes Panama hats? Panama hats are made in which country? Oh, spirit of the fountain, get that one.
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
The spirit of the fountain knows everything. Panama hats. Why, Panama hats are made in Ecuador. All right, back to our program.
Man, let's go to town. Hey, won't be long now.
All right, the Science News Studio Band. Well, when we left off, we were talking to Tim O'Connor about MetroCon and the student involvement in their conference this year.
We also invite the student volunteers. They help us, and we thank the students from University of North Texas, Texas Christian University, University of Texas in Arlington. Over the 26-year period, they have really provided the kind of volunteerism to help us make and facilitate a tremendously great conference that has nothing but great potential for growth in the technical community. And we hope to be visible and around for 26 plus more years. And with the right leadership and the right people that we have in place, we know we'll be able to go a long way to make that a reality.
Well, Tim, I'm glad you mentioned about the registration fee. Can you tell us, is there a registration fee for the conference, but is there a separate fee if somebody just wants to come and see the exhibits, or what is the registration fee, and how does that work?
The registration fee is $300 for professionals if you register early.
Okay.
And if you register late, it's $350. For students, it's $100. And for retired IEEE members, it's about $200 for the registration fee. So for you get a whole lot for one day, and also include all of your meals and all of the snacks and breaks that we have, as well as the exposure networking opportunities. So the exhibits, coming into the exhibits, if you just come into the exhibit only, and not participating in any of the papers or track session, it's pretty much free to the public. Now, we're not charging for anybody to come to just witness the exhibit. So if anybody out there just want to come, the exhibit goes on all day, pretty much all day. Exhibits start at 7:30 a.m. and goes all the way until approximately 4:30 p.m. and they break down so they could attend the post reception that starts at 5:30. So the exhibits, to answer your question, pretty much free. To attend the conference, there's a registration fee associated with attending the conference.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's Tim O'Connor, who is the IEEE,
MetroCon conference chair for this year.
Thanks a lot, and look forward to seeing everybody attending the Triple E 2013 MetroCon.
Okay, stick around. You always want to know about Engineers Without Borders, so here's your chance.
Stand by.
Well, right now I want to introduce you to Catherine Leslie. Kathy, she's called. She's the Executive Director of Engineers Without Borders USA. And, Kathy, I guess we reached you at your office in Boulder, Colorado. Is that right?
Yes, you did.
Great. Now, Engineers Without Borders, I was delighted to hear that you're a sponsor of the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference that's going on October 20th through the 23rd at the San Jose Airport Garden Hotel in California. And I was quite interested because I'd never really heard of Engineers Without Borders, but I understand your organization was founded in 2002. Tell us a little bit about the organization. What are some of the things that you do?
Well, our organization really grew out of the academic environment when our founder, Dr. Bernard Amade, who's actually a speaker at the Global Humanitarian Conference, took a group of students down to San Pablo, Belize, and inspired them to build a conveyance system from the river back up to the community. And what that allowed was the kids to go to school instead of carrying water every day. And the students came back fundamentally changed. They understood, you know, why they wanted to become an engineer, and they really identified with giving back to the community and sharing their expertise. And with that one instance, the word spread, and Dr. Amade kind of said, well, there's a Doctors Without Borders, why not an Engineers Without Borders? And that's really how we started in the U.S. So from there, that one school in 2002, we're at about 200 schools, and we have 100 professional chapters scattered around the U.S. So that's really how we took off. We do a lot of different things. We do any kind of infrastructure that engineers have a hand in, so bridges, water, sanitation, renewable energy, structures like schools, libraries, orphanages, and we do some digital divide or computer lab type of work, too.
So most of the work is done around the world. I see Africa is one place, and Nepal. No, you were in the Peace Corps stationed in Nepal. Isn't that correct? At one time,
I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Nepal, and EWB USA actually works in 45 countries, including this one, around the globe. So we truly are a global organization.
All right, and you in March of 2008. You were 10 years of civil engineering manager at Tetra Tech, but you went to become executive director of Engineers Without Borders. Now, did you leave Tetra Tech? Are you full time with Engineers Without Borders?
I am full time, but I've had kind of a path to get here. So what happened was I met Bernard in about 2003, mm-hmm. and I actually was a professional mentor that ended up taking 14 students to Mali, West Africa. Loved the organization, you know, really strongly identified with the community work, strongly identified with the students and helping them expand their knowledge. And so I actually was a full-time volunteer for 5 years until March of 2008, which is when I said, you know, I can't do two full-time jobs, and I chose EWB and left Tetra Tech.
All right. So then you are making, even though you're a volunteer, you are making a living working for Engineers Without Borders. But how is Engineers Without Borders funded? I've always wondered that, even with Doctors Without Borders. I wonder how this stuff gets funded, because it's great stuff you all do.
Well, I tell you, we all fundraise anytime, anywhere, and from anyone. So the national organization based here in Boulder, we do a lot of work with corporations who employ our engineers that are volunteers. We have a large individual giving program. We work a lot with Rotary. And then, of course, our student chapters have a lot of funding from Mom and Dad. Mm-hmm. So we fundraise anytime and anywhere.
All right. So it's not an easy thing, then, keeping the whole thing going. You're a big pardon, what was that?
I was going to say it hasn't been easy lately, but we've been able to do it and keep our programs going.
Well, it's really wonderful that you're a sponsor of the IEEE humanitarian technology conference that's going on in October, and I think that maybe will give a great deal of awareness to some of the things you're doing. And of course, this program too. This is what we want to do, is publicize the things that are going on in humanitarian. What do you see are the challenges facing your organization in the future? I'm presuming there's plenty of them, but do you have a staff of people that study areas where you could do the most good?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges that any program has these days is really looking at the work that they've been doing and making sure that they're learning the lessons that they can learn and using those lessons to keep the program moving forward. There's a lot of talk in the nonprofit world these days about monitoring and evaluation and just making sure that you know what you're doing and you understand the consequences of what you're doing, both good and bad, and making sure that they're driving things forward for that good community benefit. I think that's the big one.
What about the hot spots in the world? I mean, we hear all the time of people being kidnapped and held by different rebel groups. I think that it just happened recently in certain areas of Africa, and we see it all the time. You ever run into that, or is there a fear about that happening?
We have a really rigorous health and safety program. So we watch the Department of State warnings. We watch international SOS warnings. And we have areas of the world that we don't allow our volunteers to go because of the safety and security concerns. But we spend a lot of time on making sure our volunteers are safe and the communities are safe. So we look at it not only from the security of the country, but also from the safety of the construction that we're doing, too. So we really take a significant look at that, and there are times when we put a hold on certain countries because of that.
Well, of course, Americans are held in suspicion, you know, quite so much. I'm a reporter, and I know that many times in traveling abroad, there's times I've been suspected of working for the CIA or for being, you know, an undercover spy in the guise of a reporter. And so there are those accusations that that come up all the time. And of course, it doesn't help when a movie comes out. You find out that we actually empowered a movie crew in Iran at one particular time that weren't really a movie crew, but they were there to rescue Americans. So I presume then that it gets a little touchy once in a while. And maybe you had that problem when you were in the Peace Corps too, did you?
I had that problem in the Peace Corps for sure. You know, Peace Corps volunteers were always viewed as possible CIA agents. But I have to tell you, I don't think our chapters run into that. Number one, we work where the community invites us in, so we're not placed there by a government to start with, and the community has really reached out to our organization and said, hey, we wanted to work with you. And so we enter into those communities and those countries a little bit differently, which I think really helps. And, you know, the other thing is our guys get hot and sweaty, and they're working side by side with these community members to build whatever we happen to be building. And, you know, there's really not a lot of inquisitiveness going on behalf of our volunteers. So I think our volunteers actually are quite safe and not viewed that way.
Can you tell us some of the major projects you have coming up this next year, maybe in some of the places of the world?
Well, we have about 400 projects ongoing at any given time around the world. We have a lot in South America, of course. Guatemala and Honduras are pretty heavy for us. A lot of them are small-scale water improvements. They could be latrine improvements for sanitation. But in general, the overall water program that we've got going on is probably well over $1 million based in several different communities.
Then how do you solve the water problem? I mean, is it a matter of water sanitation, or is it a matter of just getting water up from the ground? What are some of the things you're faced with that?
Well, I think there's two significant problems. Number one is access to water or access to cleaner water. So there is a lot of our projects we do end up either harnessing a spring or pumping water. And then the second problem with that is making sure it's clean and potable. And we can have that kind of clean or potable water issue where there is an adequate water source, it's just dirty water. So those are really two big issues. The next one after that for us is the sanitation issue, so where people might just dump straight out of a school latrine onto the ground or something like that.
Yeah, the hurricane that hit and the earthquake that hit Haiti back some time ago. The complaints were that it was the relief agencies that went in and actually gave the population cholera because they were dirtying up the water. Do you all find these challenges, or that maybe there's suspicions or something when you're going to go into a particular country and try to help them, that they're worried that maybe a foreign people coming in are going to do more harm than good?
You know, we haven't found that. Our volunteers typically do not work in that immediate crisis relief area because that's not our forte. We're not trained to do that. So mm-hmm. we tend to stay out of those immediate response areas. Now, we did have folks in Haiti when the earthquake hit, but they were further out in a rural community. And the impact that they've really seen is the flood of people out of Port-au-Prince into the rural communities. And so they're really dealing with the standard access to enough water and making sure it's clean enough. So we haven't really hit those immediate crisis response issues.
It's interesting, Engineers Without Borders, because it makes one wonder that maybe the Peace Corps, which was such a big thing. I remember when John Kennedy announced that. I was just a lad in high school, and now you know how old I am. When the Peace Corps was founded, and I think Sergeant Shriver was the very first director of the Peace Corps, and I'm sure you can fill us in much more than I can. But is this the need for Engineers Without Borders and Doctors Without Borders and things like that? Is that springing up because the Peace Corps isn't getting the job done, or are you more accepted in areas than the Peace Corps, or how does that work?
Well, I think all the programs are fill a niche. I mean, there's a huge need out there, and I don't think any one program can meet that need. The Peace Corps is a longer-term placement program where the volunteers stay a minimum of 24 months in country, and they tend to work with that community over the long haul for those 24 months. Some of our most successful partnerships have been with our chapters who bring their specific technical expertise paired with a Peace Corps volunteer in that community. So Peace Corps volunteers may be English teachers, they may be engineers of a certain specialty, but EWB can bring the exact specialty that Peace Corps volunteer might need. So we work quite well together. And of course, Doctors Without Borders, you know, they do a lot of conflict type of work, refugee and emerging situation type of work. So I think there's a place for everybody. The key really is to work together to make sure you're driving forward what the community views as important.
All right, we're going to get a chance to meet you at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference in San Jose, October 20th through the 23rd. I understand you said someone from Engineers Without Borders is going to be speaking there. And what are you all planning to accomplish? What would you like to get done by being associated with a conference?
Well, our founder, Dr. Bernard Amade, will be speaking there, and I think, you know, what we hope to do in working with folks like IEEE is we just hope to bring the visibility of community-driven development to the American public, because it's not a matter of us determining what is good for those communities. It's a matter of the communities actually driving forth what they need and how we fit into that picture. So I think a lot of awareness building. Of course, we'd love it if the members in the audience become EWB USA members, but it's really working together with IEEE and with the folks that do this work there to drive it forward for the benefit of those recipient communities.
All right, Kathy, you want to put on the meditation cap for just a minute and look long range. What do you see the prospects for the developing world? Maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the road? Are we gonna continue to have a problem with global warming? Are there going to be problems with too much CO2 in the atmosphere? Are we going to solve the water problem for these countries, or maybe the energy problem or something? Give us a look into the future, maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the road.
You know, my crystal ball maybe is a little bit fuzzy today, but I'm hoping that 15 or 20 years down the road that we have been able to make an impact in the communities in which we work to make them more resilient and adaptable to change, because there's one thing that I know, and that's change is going to continue to happen. If it's not global warming, it's going to be something else. And so working with these communities to make them more resilient to change and to help them drive their quality of life in a direction that they want to drive it. I don't want to see the status quo anymore. When I went to Nepal in the 80s, it kind of looks the same today in some of those communities, and I don't want that to happen in the next 20 years.
All right. I wonder if maybe education is a problem. We see areas of the world, Pakistan, for instance, where a 14-year-old girl is shot because she wants to educate women. We find ignorance or religion standing in the way of progress of any of these places.
I don't know that it's ignorance or religion or any one thing. I think it's lack of access to education. I think it might be lack of access to market. And I think the world has become a much closer place with the advent of the cell phones and the internet. So, you know, I'm hoping some of that goes away just by sheer access and role models and examples out there.
All right. Kathy, how about a word of wisdom? Something maybe you learned late in life you wish you would have learned earlier, or something you'd like to pass on to people. Just maybe a bit of wisdom you'd like to be remembered by, or something you'd like to pass on to the listeners or people of the world, and some profound thought or creed or something that you think might be nice to have as a takeaway.
So I guess my thought would be, everybody hears all sorts of gloom and doom messages, and billions of people don't have this, that, and the other thing. And so my challenge to everybody is if you don't stand up and do one thing, that will never change. So remember that everybody's actions counts towards the end, and don't give up your hands and side that the problem can't change. Pick something up and do something about it.
All right. Kathy Leslie, the Executive Director of Engineers Without Borders, USA, in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, no problem, and thank you for inviting us. We really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks, Kathy. Bye-bye. And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
There's a lot of questions being asked of development, what development is, and how technology can be facilitating that development. And so the question is whether or not technology is the solution to the world's major social challenges. And I want to propose it's not. Actually, to think that technology can solve the world's major social challenges is a myth. And some people believe in that myth, so they are going to try to find the technical solution to the world's problems. And if we search them like that, we will fail, and we have failed. But when we work together, over the borders and within cultures, we will succeed. So I would like to plead, nobody thinks he's better than somebody else, but that we really work together. So if we do that, then we will learn from each other, and then we can see how technology can support the development in the world. Because it can. It amplitudes human intent. But by itself, it doesn't solve anything. It's about people, and it's always about people. Gerrit Jan. I'm a student also at the Nelson Mandela University, Port Elizabeth, on the south side of South Africa.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.